Appreciate the opportunity to do this again. I have this week, if I overstudy review, I get bogged down and try to put out too much information. So this is the first week I've really reviewed, and I'm overwhelmed. And people, I don't know why anyone that believes in the truth and the perpetuity of the church wouldn't find this overwhelming. I'm overwhelmed at the evidence, the circumstantial evidence of the existence of sound doctrine.
Amen.
In every century. And somewhere about the time of from 1000 to 1100, let's say from 1000 to 1200, it's just amazing. The period, the area where the Renaissance took place. You can say all you want to that it was these worldly guys resurrecting the Greek concepts. I don't think so. I think the greatest influence came from the people of God. And they have always been the proponents of learning. I have someone asked me the question, might have been Brother Binion, about stances on education. Several years ago at Old Union, I put together a list of quotes and printed it in the bulletin, and I've preserved that and used it a number of times since. It goes something like this: in the darkest of the Middle Ages in Western Europe, when the bulk of our forefathers were peasants living in poverty, ignorance, and superstition, there comes to us a ray of light from those pitiful pages of our history by the faith of a people called Waldenses. Their documents from 1100 until the Reformation revealed them to have been very much like the early Baptists of Britain and America in their religious beliefs and practices. They were, without doubt, our spiritual ancestors. They bore the cross of persecution in those centuries as none before them nor since that time. Some of their habits would do to tell to ourselves and our children. Now, I wish today that all Baptists, in desiring a reformation of our churches to get back to the old paths, would take a look at some of the things that these people stood for. One of their persecutors, Jacobus de Ribera, acknowledged that they were so well instructed in the Holy Scriptures that he had seen peasants who could recite the book of Job verbatim. Now, I rather doubt that, but who knows? At least he thought they could. Made a big impression on that persecutor. And several others who could perfectly repeat all of the New Testament. I want you to keep in mind something. God gives people according to the need. Nobody carried a Bible around in those days. It wasn't the printing press until the late 1400s. And so the Bible was in manuscript. Far more expensive than any person could afford, except a very rich person. There was no such thing as the Scriptures all being in one book. It was in many books. And then even after they printed it, it was a huge thing that heavy, expensive. It's only in recent years that a person could own and carry a complete Bible. That's just a side note, something for you to think about. So people memorized extensive portions of it. However, even though the Bible was outlawed, these people always had it translated into whatever tongue they spoke, whether it was an Italian tongue or a French tongue. Who did it? Well, some of their scholars did it. They must have been remarkably educated, far above the population around them. Even more so than the monks, who were supposed to be the custodians of knowledge, who kept the Bible in their monasteries locked up and supposedly would interpret it correctly for the people. Well, these people who insisted on translating it into the vulgar languages and reading it for themselves and memorizing huge portions of it were a real problem to the authorities, because they kept finding things that the established church was doing that was not even close to being what the Bible said. So let me go on here. Another of their persecutors, Guy de Perpignan, wrote of them, "Poor as they are content, and they live in a state of seclusion from the rest of mankind." That's how they preserve their children from being corrupted. One thing is very remarkable, that persons externally so savage and rude should have so much moral cultivation. They can all read and write. Now that's a remarkable statement when you consider that probably not 5% of the Catholic population could read and write. I don't know what the figure was, but they kept them in poverty and ignorance. And what a difference that stands out in contrast. They know French sufficiently for the understanding of the Bible and the singing of Psalms. You can scarcely find a boy among them who cannot give an intelligent account of the faith which they profess. In this, indeed, they resemble their brethren of the other valleys. Another persecutor, Renarius, claimed that he lived among them until age 17. In describing the words of the Waldensian evangelist in criticism of the Roman Church and priesthood, he wrote what they said. Now, this is the Waldensian pastors or evangelists speaking. "The priest monopolized the giving of instruction, and woe to them that take away the key of knowledge. But among us, women teach as well as men, and one disciple, as soon as he is informed himself, teaches another. Among them, the Roman priests, you can hardly find a doctor who can repeat 3 chapters of the New Testament by heart. But of us, there is scarcely a man or woman who doth not retain the whole." Isn't that amazing? How much of the scriptures can we quote today, or even tell what it says? It ought to make us examine ourselves. Martin Luther, in his preface to the Confession of the Waldenses, printed in 1533, now that's 1 year after the Italian Waldenses joined the Reformation. So they were still pretty much a separate people at that point in time. He said, "Among them he found one thing worthy of admiration, a thing unheard of in the Popish Church, that laying aside the doctrines of men, they meditated in the law of God day and night, and that they were expert and even well versed in the knowledge of the Scriptures. Whereas in the papacy, that is in the Roman Church, those who are called masters wholly neglected the Scriptures, and some of them had not so much as seen the Bible at any time." Now you're talking about priests, monks, on in years that had never even seen a Bible in their whole life. And they're supposed to be the custodians of knowledge. Theodore Beza, a colleague of John Calvin, wrote, "As for the Waldenses, I may be permitted to call them the very seed of the primitive and purer Christian church." Now this was one of the leading Calvinists. There's a book right there by George Faber. I think it's my favorite on these people. The History of the Ancient Waldenses and Albigenses, or Albigenses, whichever way you pronounce it. He's a Protestant. In the 1800s, he wrote that book, and he took the position that this was the lineage that brought the faith down through the ages, and that the Protestants got it from them. In other words, the Protestants at one point in time were trying their best to latch on to these people and claim them for their ancestors instead of the Catholics. I wonder why they quit making that claim, because they certainly haven't made it in this century. And a number, there are several books on these people. I don't have Moreland's history here with me, but I do have it, and he's the one that has so many of the documents printed in there that he brought back from the valleys in the 1500s and was translated into English, some of which are still exist in the libraries in England, and others have disappeared. This is one reason I am so convinced that this is the group that brought it all the way through. Because God saw fit to preserve just enough of their actual writings to prove what they were. And these other groups, whatever they may have been, and however sound they may have been, we have to depend upon their enemies. and what they said about them to really know very much about them. And yet from that we can see that they were very much like the others, if not exactly like them, enough so that we know that they probably many of them were very sound. I have a book list that I will make available to you that includes most of these books, if not all of them, so you don't need to write all this down. I have a book by Jean-Paul Perrine, who was supposedly a Waldensian pastor after they joined the Reformation, but he wrote a very good book. The only problem with that book is the Calvinists, who are very dishonest in their reporting in history, have reprinted the book and updated it, and you can't tell very easily where Perrine left off and the other fellow started writing. And I think that's almost criminal. I'm such a stickler about history that if you're going to update something, you make sure that whoever's reading it knows where the actual author quit and you started in. And so they try their best to make these people Calvinistic Protestants all the way back, which I don't believe. But it's a good book if you just read what Perrine wrote, and even the other man who finished it up gave some really good history in the process. There's also a book here by Peter Alex. All these are good-sized books that record these same people. Let me go back just a little bit. My favorite, which is simple to read and straightforward and gives a lot of quotes, is Baptist Church Perpetuity by W.A. Jarrell. If you have the taste for it and want to read extensively, I love Ecclesiastical Researches by Robert Robinson. A little hard to read, but all of the other writers nearly quote Robinson. In the History of the Donatist by David Benedict, who was a Baptist, he says that Robinson was a Baptist. I'd heard that before about 30 years ago, and it took me that long to find a confirmation of it. So maybe that's why I like him so well. I'm not sure. There is a history by William Jones, two volumes, that's very straightforward and easy to read, that gives a lot of the same quotes and things that you will find in the other histories. And so if you were going to start out to study this, I'd suggest you read Jarrell's first, Jones' second, and then maybe try Robinson's Ecclesiastical Researches, then look at some of these other books. If you want to get a real good doctrinal defense of the landmark position, D.B. Ray's Baptist Succession is extremely good. D.B. Ray is almost a contemporary. He lived in the 1800s, and he wrote an excellent book on why that the church has to be, according to the scriptures, perpetuated down through the ages. And I truly believe there's more evidence in the scriptures. If you know what the church really is, how to define it, the scriptures teach that it had to be that way. It has to have come all the way through. Now let me go on just a little bit here, and I'm going to make a plug for, maybe if you don't pick up on it, for how we need to make sure that we, being the Lord's only ordained teachers, that we need to make sure that we're teaching the world one way or another. Find the way to do that instead of them teaching us. Quoting Monsieur de Vigneault's writings, who was a pastor of the Piedmont Waldenses, he said, "We live in peace and harmony one with another, have intercourse and dealings chiefly among ourselves, having never mingled ourselves with the members of the Church of Rome by marrying our sons to their daughters, nor our daughters to their sons. Yet they are so pleased with our manners and customs that Catholics, both lords and others, would rather have men and maidservants from among us than from those of their own religion. And they actually come from distant parts to seek nurses among us for their little children, finding, as they say, more fidelity among our people than among their own. Wasn't that a wonderful thing that he just said there? No wonder the Reformation happened. If Catholic lords were hiring these young people who were so excellent in their Christianity to come and tutor and nurse their little children, what do you think would be the result of that? Well, I think perhaps, you know, some Martin Luther's, and not that he was tutored that way, but there was a great influence in Germany at the time Luther rose up and rebelled against the Pope that kept them from taking him out and burning him at the stake, just like they did John Huss nearly a century before in approximately the same region. There were too many powerful lords that wouldn't let that happen. I heard this Jules Smith that has all the Bibles telling about when John Wycliffe in the 1300s in England was a Catholic priest that for whatever reason rejected almost all of their falsehoods and became very sound in his doctrine. He was an early Protestant, and he managed all of his life to defy their attempts to imprison him or put him to death. And one reason he could do that, he told about how that one of the lords of the land, when they had him on trial, came riding into the city with 400 men, walked into the courtroom, pulled out his broadsword and stuck it in the floor, and pulled up a chair and sat down and said, "Now proceed." Well, see, they knew that John of Gaunt was a supporter of John Wycliffe, a defender, and so that got him out of it. The Lord provided, because he didn't intend for Wycliffe to be martyred. Now, after he died, they hated him so badly that they dug up his bones and burned them and scattered them around here and there, which is an absurd thing to do. But that man, if I'm not mistaken, one of his sons was later made king of the land. Now, this was at a time when scarcely any of the population around them were literate or moral. Certainly, we could take a lesson from our spiritual ancestors in methods of redeeming the times. So I'll not read any more of this. That's about half of it, but that gives you the quotes. I'll leave off my commentary, and we'll go on to some more points of the history. There are just a few things, a lot of things I left out, but a few things I want to go back to in way of review. There are a few people here that... What did you say that switch was? Okay. That wasn't here before. Most of you have been here before. All right, we spoke of how that the church, before John finished his letters, was afflicted by so many people departing from the faith. The great falling away that was predicted was already beginning to occur. By the middle of the second century, the great writers that you hear spoken of, like Justin Martyr and Tertullian and numbers of others, were not sound in doctrine. You wouldn't fellowship them. They were teaching baptismal regeneration and such things, or at least something that resembled that. And I don't really know where and how many of the sound churches were by, say, 200 A.D. But somewhere along about that time, or a little before, a man named Montanus in Asia Minor decided, or the Lord decided him, one of the two, that things were really getting bad and there needed to be a great revival of spiritual things. So the Montanist revival was really an attempt that spread throughout the empire to revive what was left of the Christian faith, to bring it back to the Holy Spirit primarily and back to the biblical teachings, the true doctrines. Then in 251 AD in Rome, a presbyter by the name of Novatian, protesting the lax discipline of the church there rebelled against it, and the church split, and Novation, there were many people throughout the empire that followed suit, and they became known as Novationist. Again, it's hard to tell what these churches were. It looks to me like he was an early Protestant. I don't know if he would have been sound enough to be one of us or not. I know the church that he came out of was, I think, way off the track before he pulled out of it. But I rather think that there may have been many, many churches throughout the empire that had never really departed from the faith, that took this as a encouragement to separate themselves. In the 300s, in Carthage in North Africa, Donatus did approximately the same thing, and the people who followed him and existed in across North Africa for many years were called Donatists. And something I left out last time, because I don't really know where to place these people, in Armenia, in the east, in the 5th century or thereabouts, maybe the 6th, I don't know, might have been the 7th, I'm not sure, I don't remember my dates that well, there was a man who was supposedly of the Manichaean persuasion, which is a mixture of Christianity with some Eastern ideas from Persia, a heretical belief. But there was brought to him out of Syria manuscripts of the Bible, the four Gospels and the writings of Paul. Now, I don't know what that Syrian, who he was, or nobody else does either, or what he had to say or what he told this man named Constantine, but it made a great change in his life and in his doctrine. And so he began to preach a reform movement. From that arose a people called Paulicians all across Asia Minor, from Armenia and what is now Turkey, and they had quite a following. When you read what is said about them, you find out that they were sound in very many points. Now, from the history that we have, it sounds like a Protestant movement. But from some of the things that we read about the Paulicians, it sounds like they might have been more than that, that they might have been a little sounder than a Protestant movement. If he did indeed start up a church out of Manichaeanism, reformed, that's a Protestant church. But who knows where he might have gotten influence. You see, we don't know those things, and that's one of the things that's hardest to trace, where he might have gotten help to get his work going. We know that as time went on, some of these people were transplanted into Thrace, north of Greece, and that is the Balkan Peninsula that you've been reading so much about. Bulgaria and Romania are in that region, just north of that. And we know that along a few centuries later, there were a people called Bogomiles in that region who later, and that means God have mercy, they were a praying people, who later were reputed to have immigrated to northern Italy and then into southern France. Now, how much of the influence of the people we're talking about came from these people from the East, and how much of it came from these people who had been right there between France and Italy in the mountains, they say all along, is hard to tell. I suspect that they were the same people, that they knew about each other, and that the people being persecuted by the Eastern emperors in Asia and transplanted into Thrace had heard of their brethren and migrated in considerable numbers into northern Italy. However, as it was in the United States in the Great Revival, the greater part of the people that made up the Baptists in America were converts. There weren't that many that came over here with the seed, but it was sowed among the inhabitants, and they were converted. And I'm sure that that's what happened here here, here, and here, that the greater part of the people were converts from false religion. Now, this got to be so extensive in the 1100s and the 1200s that's what got the attention of the Pope and the Catholic authorities. They were converting vast populations of people, or had already converted vast populations of people. I want to mention, if I can find it quickly, something that Mr. Jones says. I forgot to mention these people. And if I don't get on to America, Brother Tim, I think, has really been studying up on that. And please do come back and hear him. I won't be here next week, and I regret that. But I hope to be in Virginia looking at some of the evidence of the things that we're going to be talking about here on out, about what happened in our own country. About the year 1040, the Patarines. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that name means people who suffer. Had become very numerous around Milan, Italy, which is, let's see if we can get a better map here to take a look at the region we're looking at. This one may not be the best one, but it'll beat the one that's up there. I can get it right side up. Okay. Well, I'm not sure that's going to give us a very clear picture of it. But most of you that know your geography will recognize this as Italy, that now is. Wait a minute, I got Switzerland in there too. Italy's borders are right along here. But almost in the middle of northern Italy, right at the foot of the Alps, is the city of Milan in the Po River Valley. And there around that city is where these people were found situated in the year 1040. They had no connection with the Catholic Church, for they rejected not only Jerome of Syria. And that's amazing. He's the man that translated the Bible into Latin. And even many people, sound people, have referred to him as Saint Jerome or Saint Jerome. Augustine of Africa, who B.H. Carroll and Charles Spurgeon both refer to as a true Christian and a saint. And I'll tell you what, you ought to read what Robinson has to say about him. He called him a dark, confused genius. And to me, if Augustine was a saint, the devil might be too. He was about as bad as you can get, in spite of the fact that he did have a great influence on Western philosophy. He was a murderer. He was a persecutor. He was one of the first great lawyers to justify killing people in the name of Christ. Defended infant baptism, baptismal regeneration, sprinkling for baptism, on and on. Man that left 200 and some odd writings behind and had the Arians, Vandals, when they conquered his home city a few days after he died, had they just destroyed his library, Western civilization might have been a lot different. I don't know whether that would have been good or bad. I'm not to say. The Lord evidently let them be preserved for a reason. But they rejected him, and Gregory of Rome, the great Pope Gregory, Ambrose of Milan, who was a teacher of Augustine, they considered them all and all the other pretended church fathers as corruptors of Christianity. You know, they agree with me. Didn't I tell you the first night that I read the Ante-Nicene Fathers, the first volume, and after the first three, I couldn't find anybody that was sound. And so this sounds pretty good. They particularly condemned Pope Sylvester as Antichrist. Pope Sylvester was Pope during the reign of Constantine the Great in the 300s. This is the same period of time that these folks over here called Waldenses, right here on the border of France and Italy, claim that they separated from the Roman Communion. Now, it's interesting that these people over here, that some of your historians say had no connection with these, tell the same story about when they when they separated or severed fellowship with the Roman church. Don't you find that fascinating? And of course, a lot of your historians, both Catholic and Protestant, will go to great lengths to try to teach you that certain reformers, they can't agree on which ones, down the stream of time actually started these groups of people. We'll get to one here in just a moment. They particularly condemned Sylvester, and they called the adoration of the cross the mark of the beast. You ought to read what some of these people have to say about the symbol of the cross. They had no share in the state, and they took no oaths and bore no arms. The state did not trouble them, but the clergy preached, prayed, and published books against them with unabated zeal. About the year 1176, the Archbishop of Milan, an old infirm man, while preaching against them with great vehemence, dropped down in a fit and expired as soon as he had received extreme unction. Well, there's no use to read any more of that, but I just wanted you to see what those people believed beginning in the middle 11th century. Now, somewhere about the 700 and something, there was a man who was a Spaniard. I don't know what part of Spain he was from, but there's also a range of mountains that separate Spain and France. It's about 200 miles across there and about 100 miles wide. It periods long about the time we're talking about, was also a considerable refuge for dissenting Christians, those who did not agree with the Catholic Church. This man was asked or commanded, whichever the case may be, by the King of France, who was, I believe, the son of Charlemagne, and somewhat departed from his father's great devotion to the Pope, to go to Turin, or Torino, as the Italians call it, which is right there, not far from the borders of France. There's a city, quite large city. The people that we have been talking about so much, I had some of those maps with the X marked on it. Maybe I can find one here. See how this one is. Okay, that's got a dot there where... He landed just a few miles to the east of them. In other words, they were up in the valleys here between the Alpine Mountains, and Claudius of Turin was a Catholic priest, who virtually, after he got there, whether he believed that before he got there or he adopted those views, repudiated all the falsehood that the Catholics believed. And he did it very successfully. It's amazing how that, and I could read some of it to you, but we're running out of time, and you can read it for yourself in Jones's history. It's amazing how that he repudiated so many things, falsehoods of the Catholics, and how many things that we believe Claude upheld. Remind me very much of Wycliffe in the 1300s in England. Well, you know, there are people say, okay, these people originated with Claude of Turin. I don't believe that. I think they were there a long time before he was, and the evidence is there. They claimed themselves that they had been there since the days of Pope Sylvester, believing those same things. It'd be long before the Catholic Church adopted a lot of those things, like purgatory and worship of the saints and those such things as that. Now, later on in the 1100s, early 1100s, over in here in southern France, these people were numerous in this region, and this region. 1100s, a man by the name of Peter de Bruy, or Bruce, who knows how the French pronounce it, B-R-U-I-S. His people, followers, were called Petrobrusians. All that we read about Peter is that he was very sound. When he died, there was a fellow by the name of Henry of Toulouse that followed in his footsteps, and his followers were called Henricians. These people appear to me to be sound in all points that I can find about them. In fact, some people believe that some of the oldest documents that Samuel Morland brought back from the valleys of the Italian Waldenses were written by Peter de Bruges. I don't know if that's true or not. That could be. If so, these people and these people were the same people. There's name after name of people who appear to be genuine, sound preachers and their followers. There's name after name of people that were obviously Protestants. In the 1100 period, there was a man from Brescia, close to Milan, that started out to reform Italy religiously, socially, and politically. Quite a character. His name was Arnold of Brescia. Arnold was definitely not a Baptist. He was a Protestant, and he was a remarkable man. He actually ran the Pope out for about 10 years. I won't say he had him in exile, but he had him down. Had more power than the Pope. Had many of the citizens following him. And then the tables were turned, and finally through treachery and betrayal, Arnold was brought down and martyred. That's hard for some people to believe, you know, that in the middle 1000s that the Pope was actually, for a period of 10 years, dethroned, so to speak, and Arnold had a great deal of influence. There were several other characters, Protestant-type characters that we could name. One named, from France, long about the same time, named Berengarius. Berengarius did the same thing and got away with it because he went to Rome four different times and recanted his beliefs. Went right home and started teaching them again. And he managed to skillfully avoid martyrdom. And he said in his latter days he was very conscience-stricken about his denials of what he believed. Because when the Pope would call him in question, he'd just go down there and recant all of it and profess to believe what the Catholics believed and then go right back home and start teaching the Protestant doctrine again. Which, of course, Protestant doctrine is a mixture of what we believe and what the Catholics believe. However, many of these Protestants were remarkably accurate in a lot that they believed. John Wycliffe in the 1300s was a man of great influence in England and a Catholic, but he repudiated almost all of their false doctrines. Got away with it all of his life. Whereas poor William Tyndale in the 1500s was, Wycliffe actually translated the first English Bible, which you couldn't read if you had one. But Tyndale in 1500 was pursued into Holland, and in 1536 was burned at the stake for the horrible crime of translating the Bible into English. So it's not been that long ago, friends, that it was a death penalty for putting the Bible in the language that the common people could read in several places. Now, we talked about how that by the time these people had joined the Reformation, and I don't know how many of the remnants of the Patarines and the Albigenses who were over in here, I have no reason to believe the Albigenses and the Waldenses weren't the same people. In the 1200s, there was an all-out effort to exterminate them, and they did, from France. They were driven into this part of Europe, and into this part, and some of them all the way over into England. And many people think that the reason there was such, Wycliffe had such a following in the 1300s is because many of these people that fled from southern France in the 1200s had landed over all the way over in England. And I think that's probably true. But just as the Waldenses were giving over to the Reformation, the torch was passed to the Anabaptists. They appeared all over Europe. Now, there was a couple of Roman Catholic priests that converted. Of course, they were accused of being the founders. The man that's accused of being the founder of the Swiss Anabaptists is Conrad Grebel. The man that's accused of being the founder of the Dutch Anabaptists, Menno Simon, who we get the name Mennonites from. Mennonites are also descended from these Anabaptist people. Biggest thing that happened with the Anabaptists after the 1500s is the severe persecution scattered them into England, and there, within about 50 years, they arose as this new sect called Baptist. Sorry to disappoint some of you if you believe that Jesus named the church Baptist, but it wasn't called that as such until it was called that in England in the early 1600s. They were nothing different than the ancient Waldenses. They were nothing different than the Anabaptists of the 1500s. They were transplants into England, many of them Dutch, and they were called Baptist. There were two varieties. One believed in a general atonement. One believed in a limited atonement called general and particular. I call them general atonement Baptists so that no one confuses them with the general Baptist denomination of today. Now, almost as soon as the Baptists were being established in England, they were transplanted to America in small numbers, but nevertheless transplanted. And I want to get into that just a little bit. Don't want to get in Brother Tim's way, but I want to take a look at what happened in this land that was discovered by Christopher Columbus, devout Catholic, authorized by the two great inquisitors, King and Queen of Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella, who were determined, and so were their successors, to convert the world to Catholicism. It's ironic that they are the ones that authorized the man to go discover refuge for the people of God, and they really found that refuge, both not only Baptist, but many Protestant sects that were very Puritanized. This is one of the names that the churches went by, or that the sound doctrine that we're talking about went by through the ages. Cathari, which means, it's a Greek word meaning the pure, or the Puritans. And so what they were saying is we are trying to maintain a pure doctrine. It's interesting that that's what some of the people who came to New England called themselves, Puritans. The Pilgrims, of course, landed here in Massachusetts too, but they were separatist. They thought the Church of England, which had been reformed from the Catholic Church, but not nearly enough, was hopeless. So they were going to separate from it. So they were a good bit more like Baptists than were the Puritans in Massachusetts Bay around Boston, because they came over here with the idea, as I understand it, you history teachers can correct me if I'm wrong, that they ought to still be recognized as a part of the Anglican establishment. I think that disappeared pretty much after they got separated by the Atlantic Ocean. Now, they no sooner had their city set up on a hill, they intended to do what John Calvin tried to do in Geneva. He was going to blend a civil government with religion and create this city of God that Augustine had dreamed of back in the 4th century. See, most of Calvin's ideas were from Augustine. He didn't invent the idea that people born to go to heaven are born to go to hell. That's an invention of Augustine that he brought over from the pagans, in my opinion. And so these people, infected with the ideas of Calvin, were going to establish in the New World this glorious society. And they did a pretty good job in many respects. But whenever they had people come in among them, like Roger Williams, who they said had Anabaptist ideas, or Baptist ideas, they banished him. He said, you can't stay here because you're arguing against the state coercing people in matters of religion. And we're going to keep these people straight. So Roger Williams went out into this little wilderness of Rhode Island. And he and several others were banished into that region. Let's take a little better look at New England. Which is quite different now than it was then, but Providence is the location where Roger Williams landed and with his little group of people tried to start a Baptist church, which was later reorganized because they didn't go anywhere for sound baptism. He was baptized by a man who'd never been baptized, and he turned around and baptized the rest of the congregation. And then in less than 6 months, Roger Williams got disenchanted with that baptism and denied it. And for the rest of his life, he called himself a seeker, which simply means there were a group of people who thought that the church had become so corrupted that it would take some kind of a great special revelation from God in order to ever reestablish it in the world. And as far as I know, he died that way. But having Anabaptist ideas, Roger Williams was a brilliant man, and he formulated some really great things for the future of our country. And many of those things were picked up later by Thomas Jefferson. I'm not going to go in any further into that. But Williams wasn't the only one. There were four or five settlements in Rhode Island of these people who were banished, and they later came together. Some people say the oldest Baptist church is here. Others say it was here at Newport, where John Clark, a Baptist preacher, had a church. And as I told you in one of the earlier sessions, by the middle 1640s, there was a man, a preacher, who was a member of that church named Mark Luker, who was one of those that was baptized by Richard Blunt in London a few years before, who went to Holland to the Collegiate Anabaptist to obtain sound baptism, came back and baptized Samuel Blacklock, and those two preachers baptized a part of two congregations, became the first particular Baptist church in the world. That is a Calvinistic Baptist. There were already Arminian or General Atonement Baptist in many places in England when that occurred. They were the first because they inherited the beliefs of the Dutch Anabaptist, who were notoriously General Atonement. And so there's no doubt in my mind that even though the particular Baptist who made up the bulk of those who came to this country, that the General Baptists were the first in England, and that the particular Baptist inherited their spirit and their basic attitude from the Dutch Anabaptist. Now, one very confusing point in history is most of the writers of American and English history were Calvinistic, and they loathed to be connected with Arminians. Well, today we have regressed, they would say, into Arminianism. We believe in General Atonement. And I think that was a good move. It was an inevitable move. As one of the preachers back at Old Union in its early years, he said he wore an iron jacket. That means he was a diehard predestinist. But when he got warmed up, the buttons melted off. And he started preaching for everybody to repent, seek the Lord. How can you do that? He said, well, I wear an iron jacket, but when I get warmed up, the buttons melt off. Well, something about the Holy Spirit and the outpourings of revival that melt the buttons off of the iron jackets. Calvinism's got an element that's wrong. And the fact that many of our forefathers were staunch Calvinists is irrelevant to me. It's not really irrelevant, but, there's an explanation is what I'm trying to say. Now, I got off on a tangent there, but I want to get back to this, and I'm going to wrap this up very shortly. There were Baptist churches from the 1640s until, well, ever since. George Washington once referred to Rhode Island as the little Baptist colony of Rhode Island. Immediately, the charter that was set up by Williams and Clark and others said all citizens are equal and all of them have freedom of conscience in matters of religion. Never heard of before on the face of this earth when a civil government guaranteed its citizens those two things. I suppose you could be a Jew, Catholic, or an atheist in Rhode Island, vote and even run for office. You wouldn't win. But you could run. You would be much in the minority with a bunch of Baptists dominating the colony, wouldn't you? If you're an atheist, you probably wouldn't win the election, but at least you had the right. And this is an amazing thing to me, that everyone is so loath to admit that Baptists had an influence on two of the most important principles in this nation's founding, when it's so obvious. You know, the second colony to disestablish religion was Virginia. Not the colony of Virginia, the state of Virginia in 1783. 140 years before the second government in this world disestablished religion. 140 years. You think these people weren't setting an example up here all that time? I find it amazing that people would argue against that. Now let me make a couple of points, and I'm already over time, am I not? I won't take about 10 more minutes and just kind of set it up and hope I don't get in Brother Tim's way. Let's see what happened here. Let's get something up here that shows us the middle colonies. And if Brother Binion wants to use these color maps and can use them, he's welcome to them. You'll notice that about all of the colonies in 1763, which is when this is what this is depicting, stopped at the Blue Ridge Mountain range. Up here is Rhode Island. Here's where the Puritans were in Massachusetts and Connecticut. The Quakers, say just a word about the Quakers. You know, I told you about the seekers that Williams became. There were a lot of them back then, so I'm told, or a number of them. There was one in England by the name of George Fox. Well, he got that revelation. He got that revelation from God to reestablish the church. Where have you heard that since? And the result was what we call the Quakers. Well, they managed to subvert a great percentage of the General Atonement Baptist churches in England. That's one big reason that it was the particular Baptist that led the way in bringing this faith to America, is because of the harm that was done to the General Atonement Baptist in England by the revelation of George Fox. But William Penn was one of them. He was a wealthy man, had some influence, and his father had in England, and they were good people from the standpoint of good citizens, peaceful people. He got a grant of Pennsylvania, named after him, a colony to charter for refuge for the Quakers. There was a lot of toleration in this area. At one time, I understand that Delaware right here belonged or was a part of Pennsylvania. This was a nice area for any kind of people who were persecuted to land. And so in the early 1700s, there were a number of very Calvinistic Baptists settled in New Jersey, Delaware, and around the eastern part of Pennsylvania, around Philadelphia. Many of these were Welsh. Some were English. They were very Calvinistic. They adopted a confession that was modeled after the Westminster Confession, which is the English confession, the very, very predestinarian. And they were fairly numerous right in this region right here in the middle colonies. Now, Virginia was a, what I want to call it, a crown colony, very loyal to the king, very Episcopalian, Anglican. North and South Carolina were also, only they were set up quite differently, and they weren't nearly so inclined to persecute dissenters. They were more inclined to be tolerant. Now, the Lord sent a remarkable thing beginning about 1720. There was a, I won't try to explain what he was, but there was a preacher by the name of Fraelin Heisen. Is that the way to pronounce it? Fraelin Heisen, I'm not sure. Theodore Fraelin Heisen came to this country and he started preaching in New Jersey among the Dutch Reformed. Some of you may not know what that is. That's a Presbyterian from Holland. Same thing. There was a great revival, great outpouring of the Spirit. Great many of these people became convinced that you had to have a born-again experience to go to heaven. See, the Lord convinces people of that. This is the beginning of the Great Awakening. Within a few years, it had spread to the Presbyterians in New Jersey. And there were many of them got saved. It split them right down the middle. You know, there, a lot of the Presbyterians are highbrow, and they don't like emotion, they don't like religious experience, and they revert back to that time and time again. But this converted a bunch of them to the belief that you had to have this to get to heaven. Well, in the 1730s, that same thing hit up here in Massachusetts. A man named Jonathan Edwards picked it up. And a lot of other people did too. And there was a tremendous revival in this part of the world. 1735, a member of the Methodist Club, the university in England, named George Whitfield, got saved. He got real sick and thought he was going to die. And he was an Anglican priest or minister, and he got saved. He began to preach this new light experience, what it came to be called. And meanwhile, one of his buddies was down in Georgia, and he got put under conviction by a preacher that was preaching for the Moravian Brethren. And I'll not go into what they were, even though I can connect that up too. We maybe get to that some other time. But he went back home, and his brother Charles was studying under a preacher of the same persuasion in London. Charles got saved, and then John got saved. And John and Charles Wesley began to preach within the Anglican Church. A great revival broke out in England. This split the Anglican Church. In a little while, Whitefield was in America, preaching all up and down the coast in the 1740s, and this just put fuel to the fire of the revival that already started among the Dutch Reformed Presbyterian and the Puritans, and now it was among the Anglicans. Well, after all of this, and I'm not going to say the Baptists didn't have a part in it, I'm sure they did, but you didn't hear very much about it, until there were a few hundred churches of the Puritan persuasion that said, hey, you know, it's not right to have church members that aren't born of the Spirit. And so they separated from their brethren. They became known as separate Congregationalists. The regular Congregationalists would admit unsaved people as members. Separate Congregationalists said no. Who's that remind you of? Reminds you of Baptists, doesn't it? They begin to look around and say, well, you know, really the Bible teaches that we ought to be immersed after we get this experience. Who else believes that? They didn't have far to go to get that baptism, and that's where they went. Those Rhode Island Baptists that had been there patiently serving the Lord for 100 years, they went over there and got baptism. Now you've got, this is basically where the Massachusetts Baptists came from, converted from separate Congregationalists and joined the Baptist ranks by obtaining baptism from Rhode Island. There was one of these fellows that followed that path, the name Shubal Stearns. And he got a burden on his heart to go to Virginia. He first, let's get a map up here that gives us a picture of that. And I just want to introduce this to you. Introduce you to this, or however it should say that. This is the eastern part of Virginia. Okay, at this time, West Virginia was a part of Virginia. Shubal Stearns came down and spent a short period of time around Martinsburg, West Virginia. It was part of Virginia then, Berkeley County, with some regular Baptists that had come out of the Philadelphia Association. and come down into here and into here. Just barely were getting there. There had been some Baptists that had settled as early as 1714 in this region, right close to Jamestown. We think, well, we're sure they came from England and that they were General Atonement type Baptist people. These were very Calvinistic Baptist people. The separate Baptists were Calvinists from their congregational background, but less Calvinists. Does everybody have an idea what I'm talking about when I say Calvinist? We're talking about predestinarian in their beliefs. Okay. So for some reason, he didn't get along too well with these people, or didn't stay at least. So he went on down, I think, to another county, which is now West Virginia, along in here, stayed a little while. He decided for some reason, I think, maybe that it would be a little more good climate for his work if he went across the border into North Carolina. So he settled right down about there, Sandy Creek, North Carolina. North Carolina, see, this was almost to the wilderness here now. It was close to the mountains. We're talking about the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Now, from there, in 1755, it was phenomenal, a revival that rivaled anything just about that you read about in history. Right over here in Pennsylvania County, there was a preacher converted by the name of Dutton Lane, I believe his name was, and shortly after, a man of great influence by the name of Samuel Harris. He went that away. While Daniel Marshall, a remarkable preacher and a brother-in-law to Shubal Stearns, I don't know if I called his name, he was the man that led this congregation down in North Carolina, he went down into both Carolinas and Georgia and established churches all over the place down in there. Virtually all your churches in the Carolinas and in Virginia, southern part of Virginia, came from these people who were once congregationalists, very zealous people. Well, someone up in this region who had been converted under the influence, Culpeper County, of these people who were moving rather slow down into Virginia, these regular Baptists, heard about Samuel Harris, and they went down and got him and brought him up here to preach. It wasn't long till these two streams of Baptists had spread all through this part, and the authorities took notice of it. In the 1760s and early 1770s, they whipped them, they fined them, they jailed them, they confiscated their goods, ruffians drugged the preachers, they'd pull them down out of the pulpit and drag them out the door by the hair of the head or by the hand and threatened to kill them. Why? Well, they do that to us today if we were converting the whole countryside. And that's what was happening. By the time the Revolution and shortly after, Baptists were the most numerous sect in the colony. Amazing, isn't it? That's a period of about 25 years. And they just happened to have the most influence right around the home of James Madison, Orange County, and Thomas Jefferson. Where is it? Right over across the mountains here in the valley at Staunton. I can't seem to see it right there. All through here. James Monroe, close to Jefferson. Four of your first five presidents were from this region, if you include Washington, who's on over here in the more uppity-upper region of Virginia. So I'm not going to get into that, but God did this. You see, the Baptist revival waited until the rest of them had already taken hold. The Great Awakening revival came first to the Protestants and last to the Baptist. But guess who benefited the most? The Baptists did, because the Holy Spirit was convincing the other denominations of their fundamental belief, you must be born again. Because of this great awakening, and this was just the first stage of it, I'm going to say you'll hear various reports. I believe the first Great Awakening began about 1720 and didn't subside till about 1790. That's 70 years of revival. And as you know, by 1791, all the foundations of our nation had been laid, mostly through the influence of a group of men right in here. And we don't want to discount the ones in New England who were also had some influence from some mighty Baptists like Isaac Backus and John Leland to get where they needed to go. Well, I think that's about enough said, except for one more point I'm going to make. I'm going to quit for tonight. Brother Binion's going to follow next week and whatever he has, and then the week after that, hopefully, and we'll see where we are then. I want to go back to this map of the whole United States, Eastern United States. That revival sort of subsided about 1790 after it had established two denominations as the most influential in the country, Baptist, Methodist. Both of them, the fundamental plank of their teaching was a new birth experience at that time. There was a Baptist kingdom all the way down the coast. Then in the 1790s, there was just a dry spell. I think I know why. Preacher after preacher after preacher left Virginia and the Carolinas and went across the mountains to a place called Tennessee, Kentucky. Kentucky actually was a little bit ahead of Tennessee. But there's where you connect up your Tennessee and Kentucky Baptist history. Most of the preachers that came first, there were a few really bold Methodists, but the majority of them were Baptist, a few really bold Presbyterians. Then in the year 1800, up here in Logan County, Kentucky, is credited with the Second Great Awakening revival beginning on the western frontier. And I'm going to say it went till about 1820 or 25, about 20, 25 years before men started corrupting it. And by that time, it had again reached all the way back and covered the whole country. When the Second Great Awakening was ebbed out, 1825, thereabouts, you had a Baptist kingdom that reached all the way from Maine to Texas, and a comparable Methodist kingdom, all believing you must be born again, and most of their members being in that state. You also had a large segment of Presbyterians who had adopted that, and many of them were saved. There perhaps has never been a country that's had such a large percentage, a large country, of its people who knew the Lord. It's hard to mislead a people who have a daily walk with God, a communion with Him, and a voice within here as the voice of the Almighty God telling them when someone is leading them astray. How thankful we ought to be for what we have. This is the providence of God. I'm not wanting to give credit to any of these people back here. He said He would do this, and He did it. And we've got it. I don't think we're doing very well with it. There's been another great falling away, a tremendous apostasy that rivaled the first one, that began really about as soon as the apex of spirituality was reached. About 1830, along came a renegade named Charles Finney, and I detest about three-fourths of what he did, regardless of what history says about him. He was followed by Dwight L. Moody a few years later, the apostle of deception. These men were not what the Great Awakening evangelists were. They were deceivers, and there's been one right after another ever since. So, I hope I haven't tread on your territory too much, Brother Tim. I appreciate your attention. I'll get out the book list before this is over, and Brother Binion can make some copies of it.